Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Let's try it again. Whether Clinton or Trump had been elected, the new president will face enormous challenges. And the one that lies within this radio program's parameters is jobs. The middle class is hollowing out. And if you're interested in these statistics, some of these are going to be pretty surprising. You're welcome to email me, and I will give you the sources of all of these. My email address is mnemko@comcast.net, mnemko@comcast.net. Anyway, the government trumpets and the media parrots the so-called, quote, unemployment rate of 4.6%. Well, that statistic doesn't include the discouraged workers, or short- and long-term discouraged workers, two separate categories, which when you add that in, according to shadowstatistics.com, shadowstats.com, is 22% is the more realistic true unemployment rate. At the risk of overwhelming you with statistics, I got three more. The labor participation rate, that is the percentage of Americans 18 to 64 who are working, 62.7%, the lowest since early 1978. Real median household income is lower today in our supposed recovery, than in 1999. How many Americans are now on food stamps? 45 million, compared with, at the beginning of the so-called recession, 2007, 26 million. It's gone in the supposed recovery from 26 million to 45 million. Alas, it's going to get worse. The number of good jobs, that is those paying a stable middle-class income plus benefits, that number is declining further. Even the magic pill ever proposed by politicians and educators, technology careers, STEM, as I have long predicted, both on this radio show and in my writings, including in Time, is going to be a poor career choice. Because any career in which the work product can be sent over the internet is increasingly subject to offshoring to low-cost countries. And that's especially likely in, you know, software they call software development, which is the same as programming. That's especially likely in programming careers because the most populous countries, India and China, have enormous numbers of programmers willing to work for dramatically less than what U.S. software developers demand. And that doesn't count the federal and state government mandated costs on employers. Just I assembled this list for the show, and I can't believe how long it is. These are the federal government mandated costs on employers: Obamacare, paid family leave, ever rising costs of unemployment insurance. It's a flexible, it's a variable, and it keeps going up depending upon the demand. Workers' compensation, same story. Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security with increased limits, increased minimum wage, mandated time and a half overtime pay for additional employees, now managers, entry-level managers, up to $47,000 or something a year. Increased employee rights to sue for hostile environment. Those are the costs, defending that as costs. More employee rights to sue for wrongful termination and discrimination based on race, ethnicity, gender, age, and sexual orientation. All that atop paid vacation days, paid holidays, paid sick days. And so, indeed, a just-released CareerCast report lists computer programming among the top 10 most endangered careers. I mean, think about if you were an employer for computers or not. When you think about the thought of not just the cost but the paperwork of all of those required government mandate, wouldn't that make you less likely to hire people? Especially since if you're hiring them full-time benefited, that's when you got to comply with all that. If you're hiring part-time, temp, project work, there's a lot less of that. Those federally and state mandated requirements. Now, it may not be surprising, I would think, that the cost of employing Americans is likely contributing to a number of major corporate bankruptcies. Here are just a few examples. You know, these are just some well-known names that declared bankruptcy just in 2016. Don Pablo, which is the nation's second largest chain of Tex-Mex restaurants. Cosi, they're big back east. They were a huge soup, salad, and sandwich chain. Hometown Buffet, there's one out here. Johnny Carino's, the chain, there was an Italian restaurant chain. There was one in El Cerrito. And my own very favorite eatery, Sweet Tomatoes, the salad and soup buffet restaurant. All bankrupt just in 2016, all with heavy labor costs. And then there's Aeropostale, Nasty Girl, Radio Shack, and Sports Authority. And, according to the Fitch Rating Services, Sears, Nine West Shoes, which is going to kill my wife, and 99-cent stores are all on the brink. So, alas, admittedly, it's a well-intentioned fight to make employers pay a higher minimum wage, Obamacare, paid family leave, more rights to sue employers. Ironically, that is contributing to many workers ending up with zero pay and zero benefits. In addition to the jobs lost from bankruptcy, automation has already killed millions of jobs, and not just ATMs replacing bank tellers, automated checkout replacing supermarket checkers, warehouses with automated pickers. Amazon uses 22,000 of these robotic pickers from their warehouse, Walmart, zillions of others. Now, perhaps a surprising example, Starwood Hotels uses robots for room service. Were you really that glad to see a room service, you know, some guy with his hand out for a tip? They now use robots. How about this? Hilton is piloting. If you go to McLean, Virginia, the Hilton in McLean, Virginia, you will see instead of a live concierge, who very often can be bought off, you know, the restaurants are always giving, quote, tips to the concierge to get people to go to their restaurant. Well, now Hilton is piloting replacing a live concierge with Connie, the robot, which is powered, by the way, by IBM's Watson, which, by the way, is being now pilot tested to replace doctors. There was a recent study that found that among cancer patients, Dr. Watson, the robotic, 99% of the time gave the same treatment recommendations as a live doctor. At some Targets and Orchard Supplies, robots instead of people help you find what you want. I mean, do you really, you know, and you think about it, robots, they're always coming on time. They never need a break. They never annoy customers. I mean, think about when you go to, you know, a Target or whatever, are you always so happy with the people there trying to help you with what you want? Well, the robot is programmed to know everything and where everything is and whatever. I remember reading in at the Orchard one, let's say you want some certain kind of bolt. You put it in a little door in the robot, and it tells you exactly what the bolt is and exactly where it is. Pretty tough to compete. And then just open, there's Amazon Go. These are supermarkets where you don't have to check out at all. You simply walk out, and the items are automatically charged to your credit card. I had the privilege of visiting a Tesla factory. It is very different than the GM, Ford, or Chrysler plants of old. You're going to see very few people. You're going to see a lot of robots. Also, and don't you think that being, you know, this manufacturing that is with mainly robots is just local? Even in low-cost China, they're finding it cost-effective to replace humans with robots. Foxconn, which is the company that makes the iPhone and a bunch of other, you know, high-tech products, you'll visit their factory floor, and again, mainly robots, very few people, even in China. And automation is making even offshoring unnecessary. I read, I'll put that aside for a moment. A New York Times headline, quote, U.S. textile plants return with floors largely empty of people, end quote. I was reading the New Yorker this week, and it cites an example, and this is a quote. A factory in Gaffney, South Carolina, now produces 2.5 million pounds of cotton yarn a week, with fewer than 150 workers, 2.5 million pounds of cotton a week. The taxpayer bailed out GM. This is frankly one of my favorite examples. They gave them cash, and what did we get in exchange? We got GM stock, and we were told that we'd make our money back when the stock hit 53. It never came close. And so the government sold the stock at a huge loss. We lost 16.6 billion dollars. And how many jobs did we save? Well, in the late 1970s, GM employed more than 800,000 workers. Now, 209,000 worldwide. And GM does not break out how many of those jobs are U.S. jobs. A lot of those GM jobs could be elsewhere. And to put a little black cherry, if you will, on the top of the cake, GM has just reported that in early 2017, it plans to cut 2,000 jobs from its Michigan and Ohio plants. Manufacturing jobs coming back? Only politicians could claim that. And of course, not so far in the future, we're going to see driverless trucks and buses and cabs and trains. Uber is already pilot testing driverless vehicles to even put Uber drivers out. And lest you think the middle class is immune, accountants, analysts, home appraisers, insurance underwriters and adjusters, they're all, at least in part, being replaced already by automated versions. One can only look in the future. Your mammogram? It could easily be read in India. Not could be, is, very often. Legal work? A lot of it's offshored or automated. For example, e-discovery. And the Harvard Business Review just reported, this current issue, that companies such as Fidelity and Vanguard are working on automating back office jobs and even investment advising. After all, you're really going to miss your handy-dandy on-commission insurance advisor? Even journalism is suffering. In part, that's because of the rise of citizen journalists willing to write for free, like me. For example, I've written 20 essays for Time, and despite my having tried to negotiate, I'm not shy, they said, your pay is zero. Not minimum wage, zero. Take it or leave it. But now, journalism is facing yet another threat, automation. There are computer programs that are aggregating a mass of information on a news topic. For example, preparing this monologue for you obviously took a lot of hours. There are computers that are aggregating it automatically and synthesizing it into a well-sourced article. What's a president to do? What's the nation to do? President-elect Trump, and I know people don't like to call him even President-elect Trump, and they're hoping that the electors on tomorrow will not vote for him, or because they'll prove that the Russians acted on behalf of Trump, and they'll have new elections that will undo the Trump presidency. But let's assume that he is, and certainly we can say he's President-elect Trump. Both during the campaign and after winning the election, he's pledged that creating jobs was top priority. And on the heels of his getting Carrier to keep 700-plus jobs in the U.S. that were slated for Mexico, this week he met about job creation with 13 of Silicon Valley's most powerful people, including Amazon chief Jeff Bezos, Google's Larry Page, Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg, and Apple's Tim Cook. But as listeners to this program know, many, if not most, of America's intelligentsia is worried that Trump will be, and I'm going to be polite here, an ineffective president. And I was at a Democratic fundraiser this week, last Saturday, and I was seated at a table where there were three open seats. And as people were, came by to ask if they could sit in, I said, "There's a toll. You have to answer this question. What would you do with or to Donald Trump?" I swear, these were the answers, the first three answers. The first one was, "I wouldn't take his call." The second was, "I'd assassinate him." And the third is, castrate the son of a bitch. And my guest this morning on Work with Marty Nemko, in an interview before the election with now Trump senior counselor Steve Bannon, called Trump, quote, a con man and her least favorite of the GOP candidates. Nevertheless, I know that she would take his call and certainly not assassinate or castrate him. Why do I know that? Because Diana Furcott-Roth is now a member of Trump's Department of Labor transition team. She holds a bachelor's in economics from Swarthmore, considered one of America's most liberal colleges, and a master's in economics from Oxford. She was chief economist in the U.S. Department of Labor and is senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She's written five books, including Disinherited, How Washington is Betraying America's Young, which won this year's Sir Anthony Fisher Award for the book that has, quote, made the greatest contribution to public understanding of the free society. Diana Firthgott Roth, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
It's great to be with you.
Great. Well, do you have a sense of what Trump's most central efforts to increase jobs will actually consist of?
Yes, he's going to reduce taxes and roll back intrusive regulations in order to make the cost of doing business in the United States lower. It's going to encourage companies to come back and employers to keep to hire more workers.
And how will, you know, most the media and many Americans, especially here in the Bay Area, would say, yeah, he's going to lower taxes, but he's going to be lowering taxes on the rich and it's going to increase income inequality. How would, I know you can't speak for Donald Trump, but do you have a sense, being on that, you know, on that transition team, how he might respond to that criticism?
First of all, I'm speaking as a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, not as a member of the transition team.
Okay.
But looking back on the tax plan that was published by Donald Trump, and also the tax plan that is in the House of Representatives, which, as you know, tax plans have to start in the House of Representatives before they go any further. The idea of lowering taxes and broadening the base will definitely increase economic growth. Now, in the United States, the top 50% of income earners pay 97% of federal individual income taxes. The bottom 50% pay 3%. So in order to lower taxes and stimulate economic growth, which would help everybody, you necessarily have to lower taxes more on the rich than on the poor, because the bottom half only pay 3%. So that really goes without saying. Nevertheless, it's been shown that decreases in taxes have had phenomenal economic growth effects. Reagan's tax cuts in 1981, Bush's tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, and the Kennedy tax cuts in the 60s.
But the Democrats would argue, and the media has certainly parroted this, that the trickle-down economics don't trickle down. What's the counter-argument? What's the evidence for that?
Well,
for the counter-argument, I mean.
Yes. Well, the counter-argument is that we have observed that when taxes go down, the cost of doing a project, the cost of investing goes down. And so people do more investments. Businesses open more branches, and many businesses, many small businesses are taxed under the individual income tax, so there are many small businesses that benefit too. So there are more openings, and they hire more people, and economic growth increases. I mean, if you think about it, if you were going to, say, open a restaurant and make profits, and 100% of your return was going to get taken away by Uncle Sam, by the government, you wouldn't open your restaurant. Now, if you were to open your restaurant and you would get to keep all the profit, you would say, hey, this looks like a better deal. Now, the government isn't going to leave everything to you, and it's not going to take everything away. But the less it takes away, the more advantageous the project is to you. And it's like that with hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of businesses across the country and also across the world, because we have the highest corporate tax rate in the industrialized world at 35%, 39% if you include state corporate taxes. And the OECD average is about 25%. So lowering the tax, the corporate tax, to 15%, as Donald Trump has proposed to do, would really bring in trillions of dollars held offshore. There's about $2 trillion held offshore by multinationals because it would be taxed when it came in. So these have big potential to stimulate economic growth. That's why the stock market has been rocketing up since Donald Trump won the election. It's why the dollar is higher. It is why consumer confidence indices are higher. People in the Bay Area might not believe it, but people all across America do. And you can go from New York to California and only go through four states that went for Hillary Clinton. So there are millions of Americans who have hope and faith in the future.
Well, because we are in the Bay Area, one of the Bay Area objections would be that it's misleading to assert that the tax rate may be 35%, but we keep hearing again and again in the media about how corporations end up paying because there are so many loopholes. It doesn't matter what the nominal rate is. It matters the functional rate is. I mean, I seem to recall GE paying no tax despite making tons of money. What's the response to that?
Well, there are two responses. First of all, companies that depreciate equipment, that invest in equipment, do stand a lot to gain from the deductions. It also incentivizes them to spend a lot of time on figuring out how to minimize their taxes mm-hmm. by making the appropriate investments. So these companies gain, but they have to spend a certain amount of legal on lawyers and accountants to be able to do that. This is funds that would be better spent elsewhere. Second, there are other groups, other classes that cannot take advantage of all the tax preferences, all the deductions, say just a normal service company, for example, that doesn't have that many investments. So they would be better off with a decrease in the tax rate. And yes, you can name companies such as GE that can take advantage of certain tax preferences, but there are many others who cannot.
Let's turn away from that, too. And again, let's let our listeners know. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. The topic today is what is likely to accrue related to jobs under a Trump administration. And I'm privileged to have as my guest a member of Trump's Department of Labor transition team, but who nonetheless was extremely critical of him. So, you know, I hope there is, you know, it is not like she's necessarily a true believer.
I am definitely a true believer. When it comes to the policies of Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump's policies trump Hillary Clinton's anytime. And millions of Americans agreed that is why he was elected. I was very active in Women for Trump, and I'm really happy that so many women came out and voted for Donald Trump. They want less regulation, lower taxes. And once the primaries were over and Donald Trump won the primaries, I was on record as being solidly behind Donald Trump, as were millions of other Americans.
We're
very proud that Donald Trump is going to be our president.
With regard to women, you know, and I need to keep focused on jobs. That's the kind of the leash that I'm on.
Yeah, women want jobs too.
Yeah, my question is, but there are many women, you know, Hillary Clinton, especially when she spoke to women's groups, she talked about that women earn 79 cents in a dollar. She implied that there was a cabal of, you know, of men who are creating glass ceilings. And and people again in the Bay Area would say, how could any woman vote for Donald Trump, who gropes, and more importantly, related to jobs, is somebody who would not, unlike Hillary, did not exactly lament the fact that women quote earn 79 cents on the dollar.
Well, people voted for Bill Clinton even though they knew that he had abused Monitor Lewinsky, a young intern in his office. Hillary Clinton placed Betsy Wright outside the Oval Office when Bill Clinton was president to deal with, quote, bimbo eruptions. So she can't really accuse Donald Trump of anything that the American people already forgave her husband for. Besides, people were fully aware of Donald Trump's record. He has talked about it extensively. It was a known quantity, and millions of Americans still wanted him over Hillary Clinton. As to whether women make 79 cents on the dollar, it's really a statistical fluke caused by averaging the wages of all men and all women and comparing them. But you're comparing nurses to doctors, investment bankers to social workers, women who work 35 hours a week versus men who might work 50 hours a week. The only true comparison is when you take a man and a woman in the same job who have been in that job for the same amount of time. And then the amount is closer to 95 cents on the dollar. There's about a 5-cent difference that could be due to discrimination, or it could be due to things that economists just haven't been able to measure. But if you look at two first-year cashiers at Kroger's, for example, they make the same, otherwise one would be able to sue and win. two first-year associates in Jones Day Law Firm, male and female, they make the same. So the only way you get these large wage gaps is by comparing large pools of people. And in fact, if you look at childless men and women, aged about 25 to 35, you find that women make about $1.05 on a man's dollar. Women are ahead in that calculation. So it very much depends on what groups of people you compare.
Let's turn to something, you know, one of the things that, again, here in the Bay Area, but Democrats in general have been very critical of, is that Donald Trump seems to have flip-flopped. And again, I'm focusing on work-related things. He's flip-flopped, for example, on the wisdom of protectionist tactics like punitive tariffs. Where is Donald Trump now, and what do you think of that?
Well, Donald Trump has always made it clear that fair trade is important. And if you look at the Section 301 reports published every April by the U.S. Trade Representative, it lists violators of our trade treaties. It describes in detail how India is cupping our pharmaceuticals, how China and Russia are cupping our intellectual property, and the Obama administration, even though about eight of these reports have been published on the Obama watch by the Obama U.S. Trade Representative, has done absolutely nothing about these violators. These violators continue from year to year to rip off American companies. Many, by the way, are in the Bay Area. There is a fake Apple store in Beijing that is so lifelike that its employees think that they are working for the real Apple. If China can take a Hong Kong publisher out of Hong Kong and whisk him away to disappearance in China, then China can certainly close down the fake Apple store, but it chooses not to do so. So it's really important to get our existing trade deals enforced.
Okay. One of the things that certainly, again, here in the Bay Area has been so popular, President Obama and Hillary Clinton are true environmentalists. They were committed to expanding green jobs, to closing down coal companies, to expand to solar, wind. You know, notwithstanding the debacle that existed with Solyndra, there was one of the things that people in the Bay Area love most about Hillary and Obama is green jobs. How the sense is that there's going to be a lot of rollback in the prioritization of green jobs under Donald Trump. Is that true, and what's the defense of that?
Well, Donald Trump has made it clear that he's going to bring back, for example, coal jobs. One reason that Hillary Clinton lost so many blue-collar workers is that she went around saying that coal jobs are going to disappear and be shut down, whereas coal produces a significant share of U.S. electricity. If people want to pay for green jobs and solar panels, then there's no reason that alternative energy is not as good a choice as anything else. But when it comes to government subsidies for companies such as Solyndra and battery companies that just go out of business after a couple of years, that's not where taxpayers' dollars should be invested.
Well, I think the liberals would argue that just because the public wants it, the public is willing to buy tobacco, doesn't mean that we should be subsidizing it or even allowing the free market necessarily. We're imposing all kinds of restrictions on tobacco and huge, you know, prohibitive taxes. So with coal, even, quote, clean coal, if it's despoiling the environment, not just even forget about global warming, just simply polluting the air and perhaps carcinogenically, isn't it reason? I mean, how would Donald Trump respond to the fact that you don't want to create jobs in something like coal when it's so bad for society any more than we'd want to create jobs for heroin dealers?
I really don't think that you can compare coal to heroin. And emissions in the United States have been getting lower every year as old capital is phased out and new capital is brought in. Coal, as well as the possibility of it being clean, is also a fuel that other countries want to use. So China would like to import our coal because it is cleaner than Chinese coal. So we could actually reduce global emissions by exporting our coal to China, where the coal is much dirtier than the coal in the United States. So there's ways we can make coal a cleaner fuel, and we could also reduce global carbon emissions by exporting it to China so that Chinese could use our coal rather than their coal.
I've heard another defense of it, which is that we have enormous coal reserves here, and that encourages not only jobs but energy independence and national security rather than being so dependent on, for example, Middle Eastern oil. But let's turn to another topic. Well, you know, maybe the core principle that undergirds President Obama's domestic policy, and frankly it was all about, and Hillary's was all about, you know, it's all of us together. It's about redistribution. Increasing redistribution from society's haves to its have-nots. And you've spoken a little bit about the tax reduction issue, but do you have a sense of the extent to which President Trump's policies will continue or attempt to reverse that? I mean, because we have what we hear again in the Bay Area is income inequality. And President Obama and Hillary Clinton were very committed to reducing that. And thereby, if you put more money in the hands of the poor, there's going to be more spending. It's going to pump up the economy. What is President-elect Trump likely to do with regarding to income inequality?
It's very important to raise incomes of everybody, and that's why economic growth is so important, Marty. It's really important that people have a choice of what jobs to go to, and increasing GDP growth from around 1 to 2% that it is right now to 3 to 4% will provide jobs that enable people to increase their incomes. And absolute mobility is important. Intergenerational mobility is important. But we cannot have any mobility, any increase in incomes, if we don't have increases in GDP. It's extraordinarily important for men, women, and also for young people. There was my latest book, Disinherited, shows the effects of the slow economy on young people, and it is really disastrous.
Let's turn to one of the other workplace priorities, and I really want to stay focused as much as I can. I'm so curious about all
and
of it.
And also, you did say that I would be off at 2:30, and it's 2:30 now.
Oh,
so I can take one more question, then I'm...
Oh, really?
One more question.
I had said a half hour to an hour.
Yes, half hour, and we started at 2 o'clock.
No, and I'm saying when I originally emailed you, I said a half hour to an hour. I have so many more questions, so you need to get off. Is that correct?
Yes, but I'm happy to take one more question, Marty.
Okay, let me think of what it would be. I guess I need to give you a broad overall question, which simply is, what's one thing you have not said regarding President-elect Trump and jobs that is important for my listeners to hear?
It's very important that reducing taxes and reducing regulations is going to encourage employers to create jobs. Plus, repealing the Affordable Care Act is one thing that I haven't yet spoken about, because the Affordable Care Act mandates to employers kick in after an employer has 50 workers. So employers with around 49 workers have an incentive to keep their workforce low, because then they don't have to comply with the provisions of the Affordable Care Act and provide very expensive health insurance to their employees. Plus, those firms that do provide health insurance are finding it more and more expensive, so they are having to reduce workers' cash wages in order to be able to pay for this particular benefit. So in terms of job creation, repealing the Affordable Care Act will go very, very far in order to encourage employers to create jobs.
I need to follow up because it's my job. You know, the argument, again, the Bay Area, the typical, you know, Democratic argument is that that the Affordable Care Act has enabled 22 million more people who were not getting health coverage to be covered. Doesn't that need to be factored into the equation rather than just coldly looking at perhaps lowering burdens on employers to create some more jobs?
There are many, many ways of providing people with health insurance, and the Affordable Care Act is just so unsatisfactory to so many people. And there are still, even 10 years after the Affordable Care Act was signed into law, in 2020, the Congressional Budget Office still projects that 30 million people will remain uninsured. It's probably going to be more than that, because fewer people signed up for the exchanges than was forecast. So we really need to think more carefully about how we provide people with health insurance. And there are a lot of state programs, such as the one in Indiana, that give people vouchers towards their own purchase of a health insurance program that they choose. And in Indiana, Hoosiers have their own health savings accounts. They keep track of what is in these accounts, and they are far happier with their health care than people in many, many other states. It's really an example, and it's wonderful that Mike Pence, former governor of Indiana, is going to be the vice president and is going to be able to incorporate some Hoosier values into the new health care law. Well, and with that, thank you so much for having me on your show, Marty. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And it's great to be with you. Thank you.
Good. Take care. Diana Furcott-Rott is a member of the transition team for the Trump administration, especially on the U.S. Department of Labor issue in the Department of Labor, and she is a senior fellow. She was not representing Donald Trump here officially. She was representing the Manhattan Institute. As I said, I had emailed her and said it was going to be a half hour to an hour, and I was going to invite you to call to ask her some questions, and there was certainly much more I was going to be asking about. I was going to be certainly asking about his plans around affirmative action, around unions, and the minimum wage, all of that stuff, but OSHA regulations, but she decided to leave. So I did the best I could. And so what I'm going to do instead is I will invite you to call. If you have a comment in response to the interview with her, I do invite you to call the phone number here at KELW and work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And we, of course, we've got calls right away on the line, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Is it me?
It is.
Yes, hello. My name's Ariane, calling from San Francisco. I find it symbolic that she got off early. I feel that she's representing a philosophy of selfishness where capitalistic tropes manipulate statistics to aggregate wealth for the super rich while literally cannibalizes the planet. And such economists, which are economists coming out of our schools and our universities that promote the military because it supports corporations in our country that manufacture arms and promote even war, while war evokes trauma and genocide and even ecocide. This kind of form of capitalism or economics is a danger to us all, and it uses deception. And I just want to leave this with you. They found out recently that they discounted 75,000 votes from Detroit alone, and they're not willing to count them. We have to understand that there's gross deception and that the people from these private think tanks can use a tremendous amount of discipline and brain power to argue us, argue against us, and defeat us. And we have to become organized in such a way that we can find not only through statistics, but through real sacrifice and organization and hard, relentless work, most of which is invisible, to take the planet back. Because you can't argue for coal and argue for the planet at the same time. Both of those things don't coexist.
I want to thank you for the call. All lines are lighted up. I do want to encourage all the callers, please. The show has got to be, I'm required to focus on work. So a general lecture on, you know, the planet is probably not, you know, if it's tangential, if it's related somehow to work, fine, but that was pretty much not. So let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It is your turn on the air. What is your perspective?
My name is Leah from Berkeley, and the speaker was talking about how the tax cuts, how both Reagan and Bush introduced tax cuts. Well, after Reagan, the economy did not do very well. It got way improved under Clinton. After Bush, we all know the economy was in complete free fall. And after Obama, the jobless rate is down from 10% to 4%. The economy is hugely improved. So I don't know how your speaker can say that these tax cuts are good for the economy. It seems to me that the whole Trump focus has been to line the pockets of himself and his family the end the wealthy and really not for the working people.
Thank you very much. You may have missed the thanks for the call. You may have missed the beginning of the show. The statistics really are very the 4.6 unemployment percent unemployment rate is very misleading. I'll just repeat briefly some of the statistics that things are much worse than anything anybody on the streets know that there's a lot of people struggling and who are very good people who are still can't find jobs. According to shallowstats.com, when you count the number of discouraged workers, the short and long-term discouraged workers who are not actively in the market, the actual unemployment rate is 22%. And in terms of, what it's been like over the last few years, now the labor participation rate, which is the percentage of Americans 18 to 64 who are working, is 62.7%, the lowest since 1978. Real median household income is lower today than in 1999 in our supposed recovery. And there are now 45 million Americans on food stamps, compared with only 26 million in 2007. So we need to be very careful. I think both the left and right are pretty guilty of distorting statistics. And again, I know that many listeners are wondering, because we tend to be in an echo chamber here, and we tend to hear certain statistics again and again, like the 4.6% unemployment rate that the caller just said. If you'd like, my sources really are from the most authoritative sources, predominantly the federal government statistics and like. So if you're interested in the sources, I don't mind emailing them to you. So you can email me at mnemko@comcast.net. That's mnemko@comcast.net. I'm going to take one more call on this, and then I think I want to move, because I'm really interested in helping you as individuals. The show's focus is dual. There is the macro focus, caring about jobs in the macro sense nationwide, and it was important for me. I was grateful, actually, to be able to get a member of the transition team from Trump focusing on labor to come on the show, and I tried to ask all the hard questions I could. But those are still macro, and I'm interested in helping you. So we'll take one more call, and let's go to the phones, and we'll see what you have to say. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. What's on your mind?
Hello. Are you there? My name is Dr. Julianne Worm, and I live in Oakland, California. And not to kind of belabor the statistical point, but the numbers that she was trotting out about how millions of people spoke and Trump won, which we all know that Hillary Clinton won in the popular vote by something like 2.8 million. So that made me question a little bit of our other statistics. I've never heard the way anyone speak about the gender gap in pay in the way that she did, to almost kind of obliterate it. So it just calls into question, for me at least, many of the other things she was asserting, because if she's getting those numbers wrong, then obviously kind of the underlying beliefs around tax cuts for corporations and how that's going to affect the economy seems to me to be an error in thinking.
Thank you for the call. This is one area, you've noted that in regard to all the calls, I've made deliberately no comments, but I am, to be honest, quite knowledgeable about the pay gap issues. And I've studied it carefully and read a lot of articles. And the truth is that when we are comparing apples with apples, and she was the caller wasn't the guest wasn't quite right in talking about the level of comparison. But for example, I teach in the medical school at UCSF, and I know a lot about doctor salaries. And to really compare doctor salaries across gender, you need to compare specialties. So pediatricians and internists are going to make less money than, for example, surgeons, because surgeons have irregular hours, higher stress, much longer training required. And there are many more women who choose to not do surgery, much more likely to choose pediatrics or internal medicine. And yet when you compare doctors out, the media will say, will say women are being paid less. It's not at random. Many fewer women will choose to have work-life balance. I remember, for example, when BP wanted to get more women executives and offered a triple or double promotion to women if they're willing to do what it takes to get promoted, which is to move their families to other locations to get training or whatever. Very fewer women were willing to do that. There are fewer women who want to have jobs that are highly technical with no social interaction and sitting in front of a computer and learn Python or Ruby on Rails or Hadoop. They're more likely to want more balance in terms of work life that has an interaction between data and humans. And so because of that, women are earning less money because there are fewer people willing to do it, so the companies have to pay more for somebody who's willing to spend those years learning Hadoop and HTML5 and Python and Ruby on Rails. And so, truthfully, I did remember one of the statistics that, indeed, single women are earning at least a dollar, sometimes $1.05 for every dollar men earn, because before they have children, the women are willing to work more on the job. And so, you know, this is a statistic that I do know a lot about, and I do think it is, and I will use the word, I'm being careful, dishonest for any politician to assert that women earn 79 cents on the dollar for the same work. It's just averaging, because there are more women, and again, back to physicians, many more women are physicians work part-time. And so, of course, they're going to earn less. Or they work ostensibly full-time, but the average worker who works full-time, who's a woman, works 36 hours a week. The average man who works full-time works 44 hours a week. So there's a million bases on which that 79 cents in a dollar statistic that is part of the Bay Area echo chamber is simply invalid. And that I can speak to with some confidence. I'd now like to turn to the more practical issues. First of all, I'm not going to take any more calls on the macro. If you do have a problem about your work life, your own personal work life, and you would like my doing what I call a workover to help you solve a work-related problem that you're, you know, whether it's either you're unemployed or underemployed or you're well-employed and still unhappy, you've got a problem with a coworker or a boss or a supervisee or anything else, any kind of work-related problem, I can usually help. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134, that's 415-841-4134. And while I'm waiting for the calls to come in, I want to talk about what I think are solutions in an era in which all those statistics are true, where there really are is a lot of automating and offshoring and part-timing and temping. So I'd like to propose some things that I think will be relevant to you in helping you to thrive in an era where, indeed, the middle class is being hollowed out, per those statistics that I had mentioned. First, of course, it's pretty obvious you want to choose an offshore and automation-resistant career. I'll pick a few, you know, because many of the listeners to the show like to be in helping professions. I want to focus on those. I haven't done that very much, so I want to focus on that here. If you're a counselor type, you want to pick a niche that's likely to remain in demand. Counselors, while they certainly, some of it could be offshore, there's a lot of cultural competency that's difficult to acquire in another country. So counselors are generally going to be local. Even though, like, you know, many of my clients I work with by phone or Skype, still my knowledge of American cultures and subcultures makes it easier for me to be an effective counselor. So counseling is not going to likely to be offshored. And so the niches that are likely to remain in demand at any time would be things like dating. People still want to connect, or parenting, or eating disorders, or anger management. Or there are niches, especially in the Bay Area, that are likely to grow further: interracial relationship counseling, transgender counseling, immigration counseling. Those are niches that are likely to be resistant to part-timing, offshoring, etc. And let's say, you know, many people like the idea of being a counselor, but they're not entrepreneurial. They're not going to beat the bushes to get clients. So if you're not entrepreneurial, consider working for what's called employee assistance programs. Those provide counseling to corporate employees, government employees. And there are some of those as employees that kind of work directly for the organization. For example, the federal government has employee assistance people there to work on employees' drug problems, personal problems, etc. And there are other such counselors who work for employee assistance firms that provide the service to other organizations. Another thing, again, I'm focusing on Bay Area kind of centric preferences, and that is fundraising. Nonprofits' lifeblood is money. And not surprisingly, among the best-paying nonprofit jobs is what they call development specialists. It's fundraisers. These are people who specialize in extracting big dollars from wealthy individuals and corporations. That's not going to get offshored. And somebody who is, you may not even need to be a closer. You know, you're talking about, you got to be a closer, you got to close and make the ask. Some development specialists that I've spoken with who are very successful say the key is not being, you know, asking for money. It's what they call not fundraising, but friend raising. It's building a relationship so the prospect is more likely to give without an ask, or at least give based on a fundraiser's very kind of single laid back ask. Right. The other thing, of course, that I believe is that perhaps the best way to survive in an environment in which middle-class jobs with full-time and benefits are getting hollowed out is to start your own business. Of course, that enables you to instantly become a CEO even if you're an unemployed high school dropout. But, of course, self-employment's risky, but there are ways to reduce the risk. Here are just a few examples. There are many people, I want to focus not on the natural-born business person, because there are some of those, but many people feel they're not natural business people, but they would like to be self-employed. It is somewhat learnable, and as I've said on the show before, instead of running to a master's or a bachelor's degree in business, which takes years and costs a fortune, you may find it faster and cheaper if you do the following. First, of course, you have to find the idea. You want to find an idea that does motivate you, but one that is not new. The leading edge too often does turn out to be the bleeding edge. And you also want to avoid the popular fields like biotech, high tech, the environment, finance. Those tend to attract high-powered people. So unless you yourself know you're a star, you want to pick an arena with less fierce competition. How might you do that? So I like under the radar what I call business-to-business businesses. That is providing a service or product to businesses. And here's how you might do that. Think about your own life. Think about the pain points that you've encountered either in your current workplace or your previous workplace, and ask other people who if they have any of those pain points. Like, for example, a lot of businesses complain about their customer service departments. And so if somebody tells you about, yeah, we really hate our customer service department, it's expensive, it's not really serving people very well, you might contact a few other businesses to see if they also are experiencing problems with customer service. And if so, then you may have a viable business idea to help with customer service. So you might, for example, offer training into their customer service people. You might offer, you might develop a plan to help the customer base use the employer's website's help section rather than phoning customer support, which is expensive. Well, anyway, no matter what it is, once you've got a likely viable idea, of course, it's a matter of excellent execution. The best idea is going to fail unless you got great execution, good product, good service, fair price, on-time delivery, and an adequate profit margin. Don't try to compete by being the low-price leader. I certainly don't want you to be usurious. But being the low-price leader, unless you're Walmart or Amazon, your low profit margin is going to lead to failure because you don't have a corpus of cash. You're going to make mistakes, especially as a new entrepreneur, and you're not going to have the profit to recover. You're going to be broke. So you got to have a good profit margin. You got to compete on quality of product, service, delivery, not on price. Now, I'll stop there. One other thing I want to know, I do want to say this. Let's say you feel you're not a natural entrepreneur. You want to hire a successful person who's in your target business to be your consultant in developing your business plan and assisting you through at least through the launch of your business. But often a local person is going to be reluctant to help you because they're afraid it's going to hurt her business. So you might seek out somebody in another geographic location by phone or whatever. Maybe somebody's got a lot of Yelp reviews. So if you're thinking about running a business helping psychologists to market their business better, you might find somebody who does that using Yelp reviews in another geographic location, in Chicago or something. And finally, the Small Business Administration, your tax dollars are paying for this, you might as well use it. The Small Business Administration offers many good articles on starting a business and trainings in person and online. And you might particularly, I noticed that I visited in preparation for the show, the Small Business Administration website offers great advice on how to become a government contractor, that is, to sell your product or service to the government. And as you know, there is no customer that has deeper pockets than the federal or state government. So that's a particularly good niche for self-employment. So those are my thoughts about how to thrive in an era in which standard middle-class benefited jobs are likely declining. And now let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. How can I help you?
Marty, I am wondering what you can tell me about publishing things by ghostwriters.
Yes.
Or in my case about... I guess, is there a difference between ghostwriters that do fiction, that do prose, that do scientific?
Absolutely. Writing? Do you want to be the ghostwriter or do you want to use one?
use one.
Okay.
And I also want to know if they are, you pay them outright, will they take proceeds from...
Two ways. Yeah, you can either way. Sometimes, depending on if they believe... First, in answer to your first question, of course, the word ghostwriter is simply a writer. Many writers do writing under their own name. And they do write for others, and so you want to find a writer who meets basically three requirements: one, who has already experienced writing in the kind of genre you're writing. If it's novels, it should be a published novelist. If it's a how-to, it should be somebody who's written how-to, you know, in the particular area. The closer they are to your background, the better. In terms of compensating them, there are three options. One is if you're, very important, the person needs to be somebody you personally connect with, because that ghostwriter is going to be interacting with you very intimately. You want the greatest writer in the world, if you chemically don't connect, is not going to work well with you. Maybe it's somebody who you may even get along with well, but they tend to appropriate your style or your content or your biases. You want somebody who's going to honor your voice and honor your content and be somebody you can really communicate with and laugh with. Now, in terms of compensation, there's three ways. There are a small percentage who are simply going to work only for equity, but they have to be true believers in what you're writing and believe not only in your values, but believe that your content is so exceptional that in an era in which 2,000 books are published a year, that they're willing to take, to be essentially an equity partner with no cash. Most ghostwriters work for either a full cash in advance, which in the average for a book tends to be about $50,000, depending on the length of the book and the complexity, or they'll take a little less if they can have their name on the cover. So if your name is Joanne Jones with Mary Smith, the "with" go on the cover adds to their reputation, and it's also there's far more integrity in that, because I really did offend me that Hillary Clinton had a number of her books ghostwritten, including "It Takes a Village," was ghostwritten by Barbara somebody, I can't remember her name, and she refused to even put her in the acknowledgments, let alone on the cover, implying that Hillary wrote the book. That to me is unethical. So in my mind, the fairest way to do it is to offer them what's called a "with." So written by you with that author, which would cost you less. And those are my thoughts on choosing one and compensating. Is that helpful?
Yes. Thank you very much, Marty.
You're very welcome. And that is all the time we have for this week. I guess this is my last show before Christmas. And although, we call it year end or whatever, but certainly most people in this country are Christians or atheists who have a Christian tradition. So I will wish you a Merry Christmas. And for those of you who are offended by that, a Merry Year End. Winter solstice or whatever, but I certainly appreciate you very much for listening all these years. I'm in my 27th year of doing the show, and I think you can tell I continue to consider it a privilege, and I'm honored by your listenership and your intelligent and respectful calls. It's great. I also want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, who's also been my kind of substitute board op for many years, and it's always nice to see you there. We go back a long way, Debbie. So please join me again, not next Sunday. It's Christmas. It's one of those rare times I'm preempted. I will do workovers on callers on New Year's Day, and perhaps not surprising for a New Year's Day show, which happens to come out on a Sunday. Is it worth making New Year's resolutions? I will do a switch sides in the middle debate on that question with my wife, Barbara Nemco. Until New Year's Day, two Sundays from today, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
For the archives of Dr. Marty Nemco's articles, information on his 8 books, including his new book, The Best of Marty Nemco, plus how you can consult privately with Marty, you go to martynemco.com. That's MartyNemko.com. And you can join Marty again two Sundays from now at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco. That's on New Year's Day here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.